known as Abu Zubaydah, would confirm the location of a CIA black site, which is widely known to have been in Poland. The Supreme Court justices split 6-3 on the question of whether the case could proceed. In dissent, Justice Neil Gorsuch, joined by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, said the government sought to avoid further embarrassment for past misdeeds. "The facts are hard to face," he wrote. "We know already that our government treated Abu Zubaydah brutally. More than 80 waterboarding sessions, hundreds of hours of live burial, and what it calls rectal rehydration. Further evidence along the same lines may lie in government's vaults. But as embarrassing as these facts may be, there is no state secret here. This court's duty is to the rule of law and the search for truth." Justice Gorsuch wrote. He added, "We should not let shame obscure our vision." Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, on the other hand, insisted that the question at issue was a limited one. "Obviously, the court condones neither terrorism nor torture," he wrote. "But in this case, we are required to decide only a narrow evidentiary dispute." He conceded that the location of the black site had been acknowledged by an international tribunal and a former president of Poland. But he wrote that official confirmation of the location of the torture by the United States government was a different matter. "It stands to reason that a former CIA insider's confirmation of confidential cooperation between the CIA and a foreign intelligence service could damage the CIA's clandestine relationships with foreign authorities," he wrote. "Confirmation by such an insider is different in kind from speculation in the press or even by foreign courts of law, because it leaves virtually no doubt as to the veracity of the information that has been confirmed. Abu Zubaydah sought to subpoena the contractors, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, in connection with a Polish criminal investigation. The inquiry was prompted by a determination by the European Court of Human Rights that he had been tortured in 2002 and 2003 at secret sites operated by the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, including one site in Poland. When the case United States v. Hussein, No. 20827, was argued in October, David F. Klein, a lawyer for Abu Zubaydah, said he was not seeking testimony about the location of the black site. "I'm not planning to ask, did it happen in Poland," he said. Rather, David Klein said, he sought information about his client's treatment. "What happened inside Abu Zubaydah's cell between December of 2002 and September of 2003, he asked, giving the dates during which his client was understood to be held in Poland. "How was Abu Zubaydah fed? What was his medical condition? What was his cell like? And yes, was he tortured?" Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer wrote, "Questions like those would inevitably tend to confirm or deny whether the CIA operated a detention site located in Poland." In a concurring opinion endorsing Justice Breyer's bottom line, but not his reasoning, Justice Clarence Thomas, joined by Justice Samuel Alito, wrote that the executive branch was entitled to even more deference than the majority had given it. Justice Elena Kagan, in a partial dissent in the case, said she agreed that the location of the black site must be protected, but said the case could nonetheless proceed. "I would allow Abu Zubaydah to amend his request to remove all Poland-specific references," she wrote, "so that he can obtain testimony about his detention in whatever country it took place. In his dissent, Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, who had defended the Bush administration's detention policies as a Justice Department official back in 2005 and 2006, said there was no point in barring testimony about the location of the site. "We should not be ignorant as judges of what we know to be true as citizens," he wrote. The location of the CIA's detention site has been acknowledged by the former Polish president, investigated by the Council of Europe and proven beyond reasonable doubt to the European Court of Human Rights, he wrote. Doubtless, these disclosures may have done damage to national security interests, but nothing in the record of this case suggests that requiring the government to acknowledge what the world already knows to be true would invite a reasonable danger of additional harm to national security. Abu Zubaydah, whose real name is Zainul Abidin Muhammad Hussein, was captured in Pakistan in March of 2002 and was initially thought to be a high-level member of Al-Qaeda. A 2014 report from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence said the CIA later concluded that Abu Zubaydah was not a member of Al-Qaeda. He was the first prisoner held by the CIA after the 11th of September 2001 attacks to undergo so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, a euphemism for torture, which were based on a list of suggestions drawn up for use on him by Dr. Mitchell and Dr. Jessen, both psychologists. Dr. Mitchell has testified that he and Dr. Jessen, who had experience with an Air Force program that taught pilots how to resist torture, were hired by the CIA to consult on the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. They were ultimately assigned to carry out the torture techniques on him in the summer of 2002. A federal judge granted the government's motion to block the subpoena, saying that proceeding with discovery would present an unacceptable risk for disclosing state secrets. But a divided three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, California, ruled that it might be possible to segregate information protected by the state secrets privilege, which bans disclosures that could endanger national security from other materials. The full Ninth Circuit declined to rehear the panel's decision over the dissents of 12 judges who said the ruling was riddled with grave legal errors and posed a serious risk to our national security.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss very important issues, problems, and the questions our families face regarding our teenagers' upbringing. In this program, we are having a very, very learned scholar, Radhia Batul Najafi, with me. And inshallah, we will discuss about the role model of our lives, especially in our teenagers' life. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And a great scholar, we say, Hujjat al-Islam wal-Muslimin, Farman Ali Ma'asumi. And I'm so fortunate that, alhamdulillah, my husband is a great scholar. And mostly I'm benefiting from you because you are sharing beautiful sayings of Ma'asumin alayhim salam and ayat of Book of Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala. Thank you so much.
So we were discussing with our dear listeners about the role model, the Holy Quran, the riwayat of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and our Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. They have focused and they have emphasized that we should choose a role model in our life. And unfortunately, because of the situation we are facing nowadays, because of the social media, our teenagers, most of them, they are misguided in choosing and selecting their role models. So, inshallah, we will, and definitely we will benefit from your discussions also, that this is a very, very important opportunity that how we can instill the love of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam in our teenagers' heart using this beautiful quality. Because amazing. Teenagers, they are thirsty of, you know, good heroes. Qualities.
They're heroes. Looking for heroes, yeah. And definitely. They want to become like them, you know. And because this period of time is full of the quality of following, like they love to follow someone, as we discussed before too. So we should use this amazing quality, which is peak in this age of the life, for a true heroes of the life here and hereafter. Yeah, inshallah.
Definitely. And inshallah, you will share with our dear listeners the beautiful hadith and the narrations of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam also regarding this issue.
Inshallah.
So let me start with this beautiful hadith of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that he says, you upbring your children using the love of Ahlul Bayt, love of mine, and love of the Holy Quran. This is a beautiful hadith. If we utilize this hadith in our life, definitely we will be very, very successful in upbringing our teenagers.
Yeah. But it's easy to pronounce, easy to read, yeah, so soothing to
problem.
Hear. Yeah, hadith is so beautiful. But this era and this time was distraction. This nowadays is age of distraction. Like nothing allows us to sit with Quran, unfortunately. And because we as a Muslim, we are a bit slow in social media. We don't know how to make those beautiful heroes which Quran has provided for us in, you know, day-to-day life, like very, very appropriate for them, you know, according to the current problems, the current way of that. That is the challenge, you know.
Yeah. Dear listeners, we are going to take a short break. Please don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. Dear listeners, we are talking about the role models for our teenagers and how we can use this beautiful quality to upbring our teenagers according to the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam. So you were talking about that, about this beautiful quality, that it is very easy to say that we should upbring our teenagers according to the love of Ahlul Bayt and love of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, but it is very difficult to
practice. Yeah.
Practice it.
The environment doesn't allow us, you know. The environment is just stealing our children's mind,
yeah,
and their supreme time when they're fresh, when they're, you know, so most of the time they're spending away from us because of their studies, yeah, and sports and friends.
Again, it depends how kind of atmosphere you have provided them since their birth or before their birth, you know.
Beautiful.
If
okay,
you are a very good practicing Muslim and very good believers, and you have, you know, followed all the footsteps of Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam during this whole process of your child's upbringing, you know, from the spouse selection, from the, you know, birth of your child to the, you know, 12, 13 years of his age.
Such a beautiful point.
Yeah.
Like we have to go toward the root and the foundation. So you
definitely
have started from spouse selection, like, before marriage. So before marriage, if you are aware of these all beautiful qualities, then you will be more successful in teenage of your child. Yeah,
yeah.
That
then,
is a very,
then it is
very,
very
true
easy.
Point.
Yeah,
yeah, very true.
Because your child has learned so many things since his childhood, you know, from, you know, day one till now. So it is very easy to give him and feed him and give him the love of Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam. But if you are careless about these issues, you are not a very good practicing family, Muslim family, and suddenly you want to upbring your teenager in this stage, then this is very, very tough job. Very,
exactly,
very difficult.
Exactly, exactly. And I have heard this hadith that, you know, whenever you feel in your heart as a teenager and as a person, the love of Ahlul Bayt alayhim assalam, you just give dua to your mother, because mostly mothers they play a very vital role, because they spend more time, especially, you know, in childhood. So the parents, you know, if they have that love, they can transform easily. And I love the way our soul mother, Lady Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha, you know, she has devoted her whole life for Imam Ali alayhi salam, and the way she would say inna sa'id haqq as-sa'id kullu as-sa'id man ahabba aliyan ya fi hayatihi wa ba'da mamatihi. So I love it the way she used to say.
Can you translate this beautiful hadith?
Yeah, she would say that the true fortunate is the one who, and not only the true one, you know, the right one, the complete one, the perfect one, the peak of the sa'adat and fortunate, you know, belongs to the one who has that connection with Imam, although in this era, in this time where we cannot see him physically, he's not in this world, but still we can have that love and connection to our Imam.
It is a very, very tough job, but it is possible, yeah?
Exactly.
Again, we will take a small break. Inshallah, after the break, we will continue.
Inshallah.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Dear listeners, welcome back. We are discussing about the Ahlul Bayt's love, how we can instill it into our teenagers' hearts. So you were discussing and shedding light upon this.
As I said before, it's easy to say, but very tough to practice nowadays. So one of the easy way, because, you know, the teacher can guide you towards the practical, doable, tangible, easy steps, baby steps towards something very, very challengeable, yeah, tough. So if you, because Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they were not, you know, like most of them, only our last final imam is alive, but other most of the masumin alayhimus salam, infallibles, they were their time and our time is totally different. So our teenagers, mostly they have this question that how can I, you know, make them hero of my life in 2022, for example. So how can I relate to them? Yeah. So for that, I love the beautiful history and biography and, you know, the role model of some great scholars. Yeah. So, and the scholars, because they are trying their best to put their steps on and follow the steps of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, so that those scholars can play the role of the bridge, you know, between us and Ahlul Bayt. Because sometimes we don't understand that how can I practice, you know, and how can I follow, and how can I put them in my day-to-day life. So that would be such a easy way. Yeah, it's something doable. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely, because we have so many great scholars.
Yeah.
They have lived a very, very good and very, you know, beneficial life in this era, you know, in 19th and 20th and 21st century. So if we tell the stories of their life to our teenagers and give them the tangible examples of their life, then they can understand maybe. And the other way is we can, you know, tell them the stories of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Our books are full of so many stories and the incidents of their, you know, our imams' lifetimes. You know, we have, alhamdulillah, 14 infallibles, and their lives were full of so many, you know, stories and so many anecdotes. So by telling these stories to our teenagers,
yeah, I remember I remember one story which we say to our son Ali, that one day our sixth imam, he was crossing from a street, and he observed that, oh, a person, a companion is just there and crossing the street, but that companion has something in his hand, like wine, yeah, which is haram, which is forbidden. And that companion, because he suddenly, when he come across to imam, he wanted to escape, but he couldn't. Yeah, it wasn't possible for him to escape. So he's just hiding himself from imam because he feels shy because of his bad actions. So imam said, come to me. How come you are hiding yourself from me? You know, I know whatever you are doing is not good. Your action is not good, but you are you.
Wow, such a beautiful reaction of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Exactly. And youth love this kind of
because of
stories.
This lenient and very good reaction. Thank you so much for such a beautiful story.
You're most welcome.
Dear listeners, I hope you have enjoyed our beautiful discussions. If you have any comment, any suggestion, or any question, please write to us at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can, as usual, follow us on social media at Call of Islam Radio. And if you get opportunity, you can visit our website also at parstoday.com. Until our next program, fi amanillah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life. complete way.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russia's decision to attack Ukraine has ushered in a new era in its relations with the West. The United States and its allies are supplying Ukraine with arms and providing it with intelligence to fight Russian troops. But they are not directly involved in the clashes.
The only way to actually implement something like a no-fly zone is to send NATO planes into Ukrainian airspace and to shoot down Russian planes. And that could lead to a full-fledged war. In Europe, President Biden has been clear that we are not going to get into a war with Russia.
Of course the U.S. doesn't want that, because if a war breaks out between the West and Russia, the concept of mutually assured destruction will be on the table, meaning that the two sides, both nuclear powers, will be risking total annihilation. To avoid the doomsday scenario, the West has resorted to another form of warfare, the economic type. The United States and many of its allies have announced unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its financial, banking, and oil and gas sector, among others. These include sanctions on Russia's central bank, exclusion of several Russian banks from the SWIFT payment system, and a ban on Russian banks and companies' access to Western capital markets. In other words, Russia's engagement in dollar-denominated business will be severely affected. But let's not forget that for every action, there will be an opposite reaction.
Look, the dominance of the dollar has afforded America great global power, but it is now under real threat as never before, as Russia, China, and others economically challenge the US. Many are now seeking to ditch their dependence on the dollar, as Washington has continued to abuse its status as issuer of the world's reserve currency for decades, really, since after the Second World War.
Russia has already been working on plans to reduce its dependence on the trade in the dollar. Russian President Vladimir Putin visited Beijing for the opening of the Winter Olympic Games in China in early February and met with his Chinese counterpart. It was President Xi Jinping's first face-to-face meeting with another head of state in nearly 2 years, which highlights the importance of the visit. The two leaders discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to the unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. Russia has been pursuing the policy for a while. Back in April 2021, the share of Russian exports in dollars fell below 50% for the first time. Moscow's trade with Beijing is mostly responsible for the dive. There's room for improvement, though, as a majority of trade between China and Russia is done in euro, with just over 30% of the transactions conducted in their national currencies. The sweeping sanctions on Russia may push China to speed up measures to break with the US currency and create its own means of payment. The obvious option is the yuan, which is getting stronger than ever. In July, international trade in the Chinese currency set a new record, with many predicting that at this rate, the yuan will become the world's third strongest currency by 2030.
Beijing has been actively encouraging the use of its currency in trade transactions, especially under its massive Belt and Road Initiative, with China recovering more strongly than other big nations after the COVID crisis that we've had. Foreign capital has been flooding in too as Beijing opens its financial markets.
This means only one thing. Given the economic alliance between China and Russia, the sanctions might temporarily hurt Moscow, but in the long run, the West will be disarmed of its economic pressure tool.
Months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital Vienna to revive the 2015 Iran deal coming to an end. The dialogue faces a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo, and a final failure is still a possibility. There has been a flurry of diplomatic efforts in Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of the marathon negotiations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said on Thursday that talks between Iran and the P4+1 are still ongoing, and no one can say that an agreement has been reached until all outstanding important issues are resolved. The Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said extra efforts are needed to resolve the remaining issues and that everyone is now focused on the final key steps. Meanwhile, Russia's chief negotiator in Vienna says the talks are unlikely to end in failure. Mikhail Ulyanov told reporters in Vienna on Thursday evening that the remaining issues are few but need to be addressed. Ulyanov's comments were echoed by Britain's chief negotiator in Vienna, Stephanie Alcock, who said the parties are very close to an agreement. The Iranian side insisted that the talks in the Austrian capital have to reach a good deal or there will be no deal at all. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong, but Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem that is largely blamed on Donald Trump. Tehran now says the sanctions must be removed in a verifiable manner, and Washington must offer guarantees that it will not abandon the agreement again. The United States has been dragging its feet so far, but Tehran says it will not back down from its red lines.
Iran can't go through the same thing again. I mean, in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally, abrogated the JCPOA, slapped on punitive sanctions. Iran had had 3.5 years of intense economic suffering, and it doesn't want to see that happen again. It doesn't want to sign some treaty. Only to see, to see the same thing happen either in, either later this year or in 2024 when, if Donald Trump is reelected.
Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, has warned that if the Vienna talks do not lead to a good deal, the current U.S. administration will feel defeated in the near future due to lack of timely use of diplomatic opportunities. As all eyes are on the venue of the talks in Vienna, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, will visit Tehran on Saturday to hold talks with Iran's nuclear chief and other top officials. The IAEA says the two sides will discuss outstanding safeguards issues with a view to addressing them. Does Grossi's trip boost the chances of a deal in Vienna? It is hard to guess at this point. The negotiations have been very complex, and there is no guarantee that they will end in a deal. It now seems that the fate of the diplomatic effort largely depends on whether the West will finally choose to make necessary political decisions.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has blamed the American regime for the current Ukraine crisis. He demanded an end to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic of Iran has always opposed war and destruction anywhere in the world. The U.S. disrupted the stability of the country by interfering in its affairs and organizing rallies and creating a color coup. We oppose the killing of people and the destruction of the infrastructure of nations. Leader called the U.S. a perfect example and manifestation of modern ignorance, saying it feeds off the crises it creates all around the world.
Washington are glorified mobsters. That's all. America does to all of its allies. You've got to remember, there's a very good saying, if you're an American enemy, they might bribe you and bring you into their team. If you're their ally, good luck to you, sir.
Ayatollah Khamenei is referring to years of U.S. meddling in Ukraine since it became an independent state in the 1990s. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the U.S. pledged not to expand NATO eastward, close to the borders with Russia. But the U.S. and its Western allies reneged their pledges and started to include more Eastern European countries into the Western military alliance. In 2014, the U.S. implemented a color revolution in Ukraine and overthrew its democratically elected government. U.S. also supported the inclusion of right-wing groups and elements within Ukraine's government. It's now widely believed that in trying to move Ukraine into their orbit, Washington and its European allies overextended themselves, and Russia's intervention, firstly in facilitating Crimea's reunification with Moscow in 2014, then with the official recognition of the independence and sovereignty of the People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk, and now with a wider military operation to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, is the result. Elsewhere, in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said there are lessons to be drawn with regard to the Ukraine crisis. He said Western powers cannot be trusted and their support for their puppet regimes is only, quote, a mirage. Iran's leader said both Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani have acknowledged that the U.S. simply abandoned them amid their domestic crises. As the crisis unfolded in Ukraine, the country's president, Zelensky, being left alone by the West, the U.S. has refused to send in soldiers to the country to protect its people and has only pledged more money and weapons.
Well, the Ukrainian president was basically helped into power by American advisors and American campaign organizers. The Ukrainian president was told that he could go ahead and put down by force the Donbass ethnic Russians who revolted after the government in Ukraine banned their language and restricted their ethnic autonomy.
The same scenario happened in Afghanistan, when after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. disastrously pulled out of the country, leaving President Ghani and Afghan people alone in the face of Taliban fighters. The U.S. is facing backlash over its treatment of its Arab allies. Despite selling them weapons worth billions of dollars and pledging support, it has failed to provide them with sustainable security.
More desperate, they put you in a more serious situation than you were before, and the terms that they dictate to you are much, much more demanding than it would have been had you not taken the actions that they allowed you to take at the first. So Zelensky took actions against his own ethnic Russian citizens at the bidding of the United States, at their will.
It's now become apparent that the failure of successive U.S. presidents and their European allies since the end of the Soviet era has been to overestimate their own power and underestimate that of Russia, China, Iran, and other countries that are outside their sphere of influence.
Both Ukraine and Russia have suffered damage and casualties since Moscow's self-declared special military operation began on Thursday. Bombardment and shelling of Ukrainian cities continued on Monday. According to officials in Kiev, the Russian military struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, possibly killing dozens of civilians. But the Russian officials dismissed the reports of civilian deaths as not credible and part of a propaganda campaign launched by the West. The West has responded to the conflict by imposing several rounds of unprecedented sanctions on Russia, targeting its media outlets and its financial, banking, and energy sectors, among others, prompting Moscow to retaliate some of the measures. Russia says it will ride out the sanctions. The first Ukraine-Russia meeting in Belarus to reach a ceasefire concluded on Monday, with parties discussing the possibility of holding a second round of talks. Russia says it aims to, quote, denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. It also says NATO must withdraw from areas along or near Russian borders and that the West must formally recognize Moscow's control over the Crimean Peninsula.
The Russians are looking at this and seeing a redeployment of forces up to their borders from the Baltic states all the way to Korea, bellicose rhetoric coming out of Washington on a daily basis for 5 years now, and they have to know this is, it's time for us to do something. President Putin said last week, you have a knife at our throat, we had to act. And that's the mentality there. It's entirely appropriate given the recent history and the long history of relations between the U.S., Russia, Germany, Poland, and the other players in this.
Crimea has been the point of contention between the West and Moscow since its repatriation to Russia following a referendum in 2014. The U.S. and its allies reject the outcome of the vote and consider the move as illegal. Russian President Vladimir Putin said to ensure its security, his country was left with no choice but to attack Ukraine. The country also says the conflict in its western neighbor roots back years.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbass. And again, today, you did not mention at all the suffering of the residents of Donbass.
The radical nationalists, according to Russian officials, are funded and aided by the West to create a buffer zone between the two sides. That comes on top of NATO's numerous war games near Russian borders, exercises the Kremlin has slammed as provocative. But those are not the only destructive measures the Western nations, especially the U.S., have taken. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from many international accords, including key treaties with Russia, and namely the Cold War-era Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, INF, and the Open Skies Treaty. The pacts were signed in the late 80s and early 90s as means to de-escalate tensions, risking to spiral into an all-out nuclear war.
The withdrawal of the U.S. from the INF and the Open Skies Treaty and all of that tend to undermine the kind of confidence that's required right now to avoid a war. That's the first thing that has to be considered. Secondly, is that in the absence of that treaty, of course, we can assume that one of the most violative of those treaty weapons are available or probably deployed and as close to Russia as possible. Russians, certainly, military planners have to assume that. And that, again, puts them on a hair trigger in terms of deciding whether or not to fire a defense against what looks like an incoming attack.
It appears we're getting there again. The president has ordered the military to put the nuclear deterrent forces on high alert, citing what he called unfriendly gestures made by the West. The French foreign minister had earlier warned that the bloc was a nuclear power. Although experts believe the threats about a nuclear confrontation are not to lose any sleep over, the fact of them being mentioned is worrisome to many. Washington says it doesn't want to be a part of a direct conflict with Russia. Why did it pick a fight with the power then, if it wasn't willing to face the music?
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
A zoo in Peru's capital city, Lima, is celebrating a rare hatching of endangered baby crocodiles. The Huachipa Zoo showcased three females and one male to the public on the World Wildlife Day. The four crocodiles were born in incubators as part of the conservation efforts for the reptile. This species is an American crocodile, which is on the endangered list of animals in Peru. Zookeepers say the black market and threats on their habitat have seen the crocodile population dwindle. The zoo regularly receives animals that were rescued from trafficking. Among those traits are tortoises, macaws, and monkeys.
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico, and United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoogh, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Hoogh's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran dubbed Promotion of Persian Language on Global Scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Iran Imruz.
Persian language has been spoken for 3 millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity. The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
1,000 years ago, Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di, and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets.
Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
It is now well-established facts that animals feel, think, behave, and even experience pain. Thus, they should be treated with the same respect as humans, while a center in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is doing the same, life-saving services to injured apes. The sanctuary, located in a vast national park, has been active for 2 decades. The center houses scores of chimpanzees, gorillas, and endangered great apes. Bonobos and bombos as well. Most of the animals that are brought to the sanctuary were rescued from poachers. The staff there provide medical care to the injured animals until they are healthy enough to be integrated into a group of their fellow species.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf. The 16th Fajr International Poetry Festival has wrapped up with an award ceremony in Tehran. The literary event aims to honor Persian poets from Iran and the world with the ultimate goal of elevating Persian poetry. Yusuf Jalali has more.
An occasion to honor poets and poetry. The 16th edition of Fajr International Poetry Festival saw its closing ceremony in Tehran, where the best Persian poetry works of the year were acknowledged and awarded. During the event, participants from Iran and other countries contended in different categories, including classic poetry, modern poetry, and children and young adults.
I won the prize for the best poetry book for children and young adults. My book is titled Silence in the Mother Tongue. I'm so glad that my effort is seen, judged, and acknowledged by top Iranian literary personalities from the jury of the festival.
Certainly, Fajr Poetry Festival is of great significance to me as an Afghan poet. Here, literary experts from Iran, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the world can network and make joint efforts to promote the Persian language.
Iran is known as the land of poets, being home to many world-renowned literary figures over the centuries, including Rumi, Hafez, and Khayyam. Experts here believe Persian poetry has no expiry date, and not only do Iranians still read ancient poems, they're also interested in modern prose and poetry.
Poetry is a beautiful language that speaks the beauty of the world, and such a language always communicates very well with the hearts of human beings. Iranians have long understood the beauty of this language and still listen to it and read it in its every form and genre.
Fajr International Poetry Festival was launched in 2006 as a platform for Persian poets from Iran and other Persian-speaking countries to get together for the elevation of Persian poetry. However, the literary event has grown to encompass non-Persian poets who are interested in Iranian literature.
Poetry holds a special position among Iranians, and you can rarely find an Iranian family that doesn't have a poetry book in their bookshelves. Now, aside from acknowledging Persian literary figures and poets, Fajr Festival seeks to preserve this long-standing culture and introduce it to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
www.parstoday.com/EN